Hello, welcome everyone, and good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsco, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Women Affairs Council. I'd like to thank everyone for coming to this special program we have today. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Our program is being recorded for radio on KSPA, so if you wouldn't mind turning off those wonderful ringtones and save them for later. We are a membership organization, and if you currently are not a membership or member, do so today. We have a special going on where if you become a member today, your membership will be good for the remainder part of this year and all of our next program year. At this time, I'd like to recognize any students present. We know it's getting close to finals time. Have any students wandered down? Fabulous. And I'd like to thank Dr. Meineke so much for visiting South High School today. He spoke to two rooms full of 200 students each, so 400 students today at South were able to hear a compelling presentation by our speaker. Thank you so much for bringing that to our community. And I'd like to also thank BP, our sponsor of all of our student meals today and all of our weekly programs. I'd also like to recognize the Alaska Jewish Museum, who has helped making this program possible today. Thank you, Rabbi Eber and the Jewish Museum. I'm KSKA. Today's program will be in a different format, as you can see. After approximately 40 minutes, Mr. Gostin will open the floor for questions. So if you could please wait for the microphone to come to you, because once again, this will be recorded for KSKA. I'd like to introduce David right now, and he will introduce our speaker. David Gostin is a lifelong third-generation Alaskan. He attended the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School with a degree in economics. He spent almost 15 years as a supply chain manager in the grocery business, and has spent the last 20 years as a company analyst and as registered investment advisor, and as a president and chief investment officer of Dynamic Capital Management, Inc. He's been active in Alaskan oil and gas politics for 30 years, and is also active in national politics regarding peace in the Middle East through his role as the Alaska chair for the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. Please join me in welcoming both Dr. Meineke and David Gostin to our podium today.
Pleasure to be here, and I say there are three good things. First is that summer's coming, and two, it's not often you get this many Alaskans in a room where it's not a fundraiser, so I'm sure we're all happy about that. And then we also are blessed to have Dr. Meineke with us today. We're going to have a very highly informative discussion about the seeds that were necessary and what took place to bring Hitler and the Nazi Party to power in ways that I had never even been aware of. And Dr. Meineke is truly a great scholar, and he's spent, I'm sure, way longer than any of us would want to imagine going through all sorts of documents in German. He speaks German, reads it, and has just an unbelievable insight in terms of being able to peel the onion back in terms of what happened. So we're going to kind of take you back in history and let him answer some questions for you. But I want to first tell you about him so that we know a little bit in terms of where he's coming from. William Frederick Meineke was born in May of 1961 in Baltimore, Maryland. He received his undergraduate degree in German and history from the University of Maryland in Baltimore County in 1983. He attended the universities of Bonn and Berlin in Germany and received his MA in 1988 and also his PhD in 1998 in history from the University of Maryland at College Park. The title of his dissertation was Conflicting Loyalties, the Supreme Court in Weimar and Nazi Germany, 1918 to 1945. And in 1992, William joined the staff of the Wexner Learning Center of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. He was on the design team of the center's multimedia program on the Holocaust, the Historical Atlas of the Holocaust, it's on book and CD-ROM, and the student learning website on the Holocaust. In June 2000, William joined the staff of the museum's education division. For the last 7 years, Roit has worked with law enforcement officers, judges, prosecutors, and attorneys in law enforcement. He is currently working with the National Institute for Holocaust Education on Holocaust Education for Adult Professionals. His book, Nazi Ideology and Holocaust, was published by the museum in December of 2007. So I want to again give him a warm welcome. I have a series of questions that I'm going to just, you know, seed him with, because he's going to be able to talk at much greater length than I'm sure we have time for. So he's just going to start. And I wanted to start by saying, how did the Nazis come to power? And that's probably a different answer than many of us may have thought of in the past.
Yeah, I think because I'm a different kind of historian than most people would expect. I like to look at history from the ground up rather than from the up down, from the top down. So looking at what people, ordinary people, were thinking, what was the context within which they were making decisions, what kind of decisions were they making at the time. And there's layers upon layers, like you say, peeling the onion back of the context within which ordinary Germans were operating in the early 1930s. Now, Hitler's appointed chancellor in January 1933. He's not elected into office, although the Nazis are the largest party in parliament. They don't have a majority. They can't pass legislation. And the context to understand how he gets appointed chancellor is really complex. It goes back to the 1929 stock market crash here in the United States and the repercussions, how that played out abroad. Some 6 million Germans were thrown out of work. That meant about 20 million Germans in a country of 60 million had no visible means of support, were dependent on public welfare in order just to feed their families. Tremendous suffering in the streets of Germany, not just Berlin, but cities and villages all across Germany. More and more Germans lost faith in the ability of democracy to handle the problem. And they began to vote, as a political crisis, far right and far left. They were voting for a radical solution because democracy wasn't solving the problem for them. They began to vote communist and Nazi in larger and larger numbers. And that political crisis then led to a constitutional crisis. The only time those two ever got together to vote together was to vote down the government. So the government is at an impasse. Parliament cannot pass legislation. In that power vacuum, the authority of the president expanded, and more Germany became ruled by presidential decree. Hindenburg, he was a war hero from World War I. Savior Tannenberg, he saved Germany from Russian invasion in the first year of the war. He's president since 1925. He, of all Germans, has a mandate to rule Germany, elected by universal suffrage in 1925, re-elected in 1932. He, I think, is really, although he's not a Democrat, he much would prefer a constitutional monarchy. He took his oath to the Constitution seriously, and he was trying to restore orderly government. And his advisors told them that they could use whatever support the Nazis had to restore orderly government, and not enact a Nazi agenda, but a nationalist patriotic agenda. That Hitler would just be the front man for their own agenda. And then the added advantage to that was that Hitler wouldn't be able to criticize the government because he's part of the government. So Hindenburg takes that chance and invites Hitler into power as chancellor, as a junior partner to the coalition. So it's a coalition government. The Nazis can't have everything their own way. In fact, this is tantamount to an alliance between the nationalist, the patriotic front, the German National People's Party, and non-Nazi professionals in the administration. And it's an alliance that stands down to when they try to kill him in July 1944. So it remains in place. And that means it limits what Hitler can do. He knows, on one hand, that most Germans didn't agree with him or they would have voted for the Nazis. So he's got to win the hearts and the minds of the German people. And he's got to figure out how he can enact a Nazi agenda with an administration that is largely non-Nazi. And that's really what the heart of this program is look at the reaction of legal professionals, medical professionals, education professionals, police professionals, how they reacted to the demands of a Nazi German state. How did these professions then become Nazified? And what were the decisions that they were making on the local level?
That brings us to the next question, because one of the things that you have a great amount of expertise is, in effect, you say, Hitler couldn't do it alone. He had a lot of accomplices, in effect.
Oh, yeah.
And can you talk about the power elites and the professionals and others that and their thought processes and how they contributed to what took place?
you know, Germany is in crisis. They recognize that Germany is in crisis, and many of the professions are also in crisis. They're under stress from democracy. You know, one of the things that drew me to this history was that in the span of one person's career, you know, I was studying the judicial system, in the span of one judge's career, Germany went from an authoritarian monarchy to a liberal democracy, to Nazi dictatorship, to occupation by foreign powers, to the creation of a new democracy after the war. And they're applying really the same law. They're applying, and they think the same way. That despite the radical political changes and the radical social changes, especially in the transition to liberal democracy, they think they're doing the same job they've always done. And even in 1945, many judges, lawyers, prosecutors insisted that they're not responsible for Nazi injustice. They were just applying the law. They were doing the same things they always do. So how can that be a crime? And that's what I really wanted to get at and examine. So some of them, they really liked the Nazi agenda about restoring strength and overturning Versailles and putting Germany on the right footing again, will return to the traditional values of imperial society. In fact, the Nazis were very astute. They didn't call themselves a Nazi government. They called themselves the government of national reconciliation. That this was bringing all national-minded Germans together to work together to save Germany. And that's how they really presented their agenda, what they were doing. Now, it dovetails with the crisis in the professions, that the Republic, one thing that it had done was open the professions to the masses. So really anybody could be a lawyer, anybody could be a doctor, anybody could be an education professional. You just needed the education qualifications. And that meant then, for example, lawyers were in deep crisis. Their numbers had practically doubled, had nearly doubled, and their income had plummeted. So really 1 in 10 was earning nothing. And about a quarter couldn't earn enough to support their families. They had to do something else. So they saw it as a professional crisis, a crisis of professionalization. So those, you know, interest in saving Germany dovetailed with interest in saving the profession. And I have to say, one thing the Nazis did do was they reduced the number of lawyers by a quarter and quadrupled the average income. So, I mean, that plays a role in this, that they're getting some advantage from Nazi policy. And, of course, the way they do that is they target Nazi political opponents who are lawyers, so communists, socialists, left liberals, pacifists, and they target Jews. And by removing them from the profession, they create an advantage for those non-Jewish professionals that are left and create an interest, a common interest between the Nazi state and these non-Nazi professions, that they have a stake in the maintenance of the Nazi system and the strengthening of the Nazi system because they benefited from the Nazi system.
Interesting. In what had been a country governed by the rule of law, how did the German judiciary react to the election of Hitler and other subsequent Nazi and German activities?
That's a great question, because you know, you have to wonder, did they view the government as legitimate? If, you know, if there's an economic crisis and a political crisis and a constitutional crisis, there were lots of things to point at to question the legitimacy of Hindenburg's decision to appoint Hitler chancellor. Hitler was, on almost daily basis, violating the Constitution, even before the Enabling Act that authorized him to pass legislation that altered the Constitution. For example, in the aftermath of the Reichstag fire, the arson attack on the government building, that was the justification for the state of emergency, the passing of the decree for the protection of the people in the state, which put out of force important provisions of the Constitution, those that safeguarded individual rights and due process of law, and gave the police unfettered authority to arrest anybody they wanted to arrest and incarcerate anybody they wanted to incarcerate without resorting to judicial review, without going to a judge or a prosecutor or a lawyer, without obtaining a warrant. It became unfettered police authority. And I was shocked that the reaction of the judicial system was one of relief. There was a general sense, especially in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, these are men at the peak of their profession. They have judicial protections. They can't be removed except on the basis of a judicial decision. They can't be transferred. Their pay cannot be lowered. I mean, that's the sense of judicial independence. They're particularly mandated to ignore any kind of order from the government about how to decide a case and to ignore public pressure about how to decide the case and just decide cases on the points of law. And their reaction is relief, because at least then these cases, the Nazis are targeting the right people, Jews and socialists and communists and trade unionists, people who really don't have Germany's best interests at heart, so they say. And they're doing it in a way that expedites justice without overloading the justice system. So they fundamentally approved of it. And you see this especially in the decision of the Reichstag fire trial. They actually try the person they caught spreading the flames in the Reichstag. His name was Marinus van der Lubbe. He's not even German, he's a Dutchman, who came to Berlin because he was outraged at the passivity of the Communist Party. And he thought that some kind of dramatic action would spark a reaction from communists. So he lit these paraffin lighters that you use to light coal and started throwing them into the gallery of the Parliament building, and it caught fire like torchwood. But he's caught actually doing that. So it was clear that he's involved and that he has a part of it. But the Nazis insisted they try 7 communist co-defendants. These are the leaders of the communist delegation in Parliament and 3 members of the Communist International that they caught in Germany at the time. Now, you can imagine that Hitler and the Supreme Court president, his name was Erwin Bumke, not a Nazi. He's an old-style conservative Prussian official. They're talking back and forth, and Hitler's saying, look, ignore the evidence in this case, because it's the justification for the state of emergency. You have to find the communist co-defendants guilty. So the court is left with this pressure from the government to say, ignore your duty, and instead apply an appeal to political necessity. And the court takes a very interesting action. It's using the level where the line is between the requirements for political loyalty and the requirements to follow the law sit. The long decision, 25 pages, 30 pages, and courts then, as courts now, they spend a long time justifying how they came to their decision. And the court took a very interesting position. First, it said they recognized that, this is the way they put it, Germany is in transition to a more authoritarian system. So we have to, pay really close attention to the requirements of the government. So they're going to take that very seriously. Then they went on to say that while they agreed with the government, there really was a communist conspiracy to overthrow the state, they didn't see the evidence for these particular defendants, and they found them all but Marinus van der Lubbe not guilty and ordered their release. The second step is that Hitler is a vindictive sort. I mean, personally, he's really a foul, vindictive, petty person. He passed a law that was called Lex van der Lubbe, which really made it a capital offense to commit an arson against a public building from January 30th, when he was appointed, to March 1st, the day after the Reichstag fire decree. Specifically, so it's a law that's clearly aimed at forcing the death penalty for those who were convicted of setting the fire. So the court has to decide, do we apply this ex post facto law, which violates a long-standing judicial principle, no crime without prior law, or not? And they did what courts did then. They thought of their role as reinforcing government authority. That's their primary duty. And their job was to look at the law and decide whether the law was legitimately constituted. And if they decided that it was, they had no choice but to apply it. So in looking at the law, they decided that the state of emergency and then the Enabling Act, which granted legislation to the government, was a legitimate process. And they officially said it was a legitimate process. Therefore, that law, Lex van der Lubbe, was a legitimate law, and they had no choice but to apply it. So they found him guilty and sentenced him to death.
What you're describing is a process where the judiciary, and the reason we're spending time on this is it becomes part of the fabric of society.
Absolutely.
And so you're kind of taking us through different stages of how the judiciary morphed, perhaps, into a new molding that could survive in the new order. So where did it go? Where was the post-Hitler establishment judiciary? Where did it get to in terms of that?
How bad did it get?
Yes.
Well, I mean, just point out the fact that these learned men that were in their profession long before Hitler ever came to power, that have spent their lives to the career in serving the law, the fact that they acknowledge that the Nazis are right and they're doing legitimate policy and they're willing to apply it themselves, that ordinary Germans look at that and say, well, if these learned, they're all educated, they're all college doctorates, they're at the Supreme Court, the peer, the pinnacle of our system, if they say it was legitimate and they apply it, then who am I to say it wasn't? And that's really the first chink in the armor in civil society. That opens the door to a whole series of things. If you agree that the government was legitimate, then they have to be able to apply their policies, right? That becomes the voice of the nation. And then it becomes the individual against the voice of the nation. And that's the entree into it. Then that perverts the medical professions. It perverts the education professions, of course, so that kids in school, the curriculum gets warped. It gets changed into really emphasizing two subjects. One is physical fitness, because the Nazis insisted that Germans, racially acceptable Germans, should be fit. And second, race hygiene, or the national community and racism. That they teach Germans in the lower grades to love Germany, and in the upper grades to recognize the enemy within and to hate them, especially Jews. And that becomes then the core of the educational mission of the state. That's how they're going to create this unitary society where what they call the Volksgemeinschaft, the national community, which is also a legal concept used in law. National community, Volksgemeinschaft, the word folk in German has a connotation that it doesn't have in English. I mean, it's translated as people or nation or race. But in German, it has a mystical connotation of people united by common blood, sharing a common destiny under the leadership of the Nazi Party. And that's really what it means. And for that to happen, that means they have to accept the basic tenets of a racial community, a community based in common ancestry, in common culture, in common goals. And of course, the leader of the nation, Hitler, and the Nazi Party are showing them the direction the country should go.
We're going to change gears a little bit here and now talk about the intersection, about how this legal, judicial, and justification template was a platform to which that led to the Holocaust, the things that led to the Holocaust. And so, well, I'll first ask, because nothing happened just in a vacuum.
Nothing happened.
Is what was taught in the Nazi-controlled schools during this period?
Yeah. I mean, the Nazis, when you're trying to control what happens in the classroom, well, how do you do that in a country that has about 8 million students? So, and the Nazis, remember, they're reliant on educational professionals. Many of them are non-Nazi. They're all patriotic. They all teach the glories of Germany. That wouldn't seem unusual to a teacher, even today, I wouldn't think. But at the time, the Nazis really want schools to be geared towards physical fitness in education, and also in race hygiene, racism, to understand the basic principles of Nazi racial ideology. And there are numerous ways you can do that. You can change the national testing, the school leaving exam. The British call it A-levels. The Germans called it the Abitur. We just call it the high school diploma. But they have to take a series of exams. Well, they can require that gym and Nazi race hygiene be required subjects for that test. That means then the students are going to have to put effort into understanding and understanding what the Nazi message was in order to get a decent grade for their high school so that they can enter college and have a good degree. So that already gives incentive, so that teachers are already then signaled they have to move in that direction. And some teachers were very good at it, and some teachers really took the path of least resistance and really use really crass racism in the classroom. There are lots of survivor stories about being singled out as a Jewish school child in a German public school system and say, well, here we're having our lesson on race hygiene. Let's bring up Heinrich. Here's our German example. Oh, yes, and we're fortunate enough and maybe unfortunate enough to have a Jew in the classroom. Let's bring him up, and then we can compare their racial features and show really how, he is really inferior and really a detriment to German society.
Was it part of this whole purist idea that we need to get to this pure German blood, and that's where part of the separation takes place?
It was part of the formula about how to restore German greatness and to have a future where Germany then, has a glorious future.
Can you elaborate on the mindset of the German people at the time regarding their feelings towards Jews, who represented about 1% of the German population? And why? And you said something very interesting last night. Why it didn't take coercion for so many to participate in the atrocities against the Jewish people? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can talk about that, because I found it puzzling myself, and I really had to look at this very carefully. Because if you look at history of anti-Semitism in the Western world, I mean, the Germans aren't unique here. There's anti-Semitic threads in every Western society. In fact, if you know, it was Professor Mossa at Chicago University, who since passed away, who said, look, if you could take a time machine back to the turn of the century, 1900, and tell people then that within 50 years, a major European power would try to kill all the Jews of Europe, people then would have reacted, I knew you couldn't trust the French. You know, Napoleon tried to take over, and they're going to do it again. And the Dreyfus Affair meant that, you know, to many, that anti-Semitism was a real central problem in French society. So it made sense that the French would perpetrate it. Or they would have said, I knew, you know, those Russians aren't really a Western power, that they're, you know, kind of Asiatic, and they're going to destroy. Because of the example they have of the many pogroms in Eastern Europe, where hundreds and thousands of Jews were killed by popular mobs really sent by the government. No one would have thought it would be the Germans. I mean, that's the problem. The Jewish community in Germany seemed the most secure, seemed the most stable. They thought of themselves as German first, and they happened to go to synagogue on Saturday. I mean, that was their only difference. They speak German like everyone else. They dress like everyone else. They're fully integrated into German society. They seemed completely secure. So in some sense, it makes no sense that the Holocaust happens in Germany. It would make more sense if it happened somewhere else. And that's part of the historical problem with dealing with this history. I think it helps that Hitler himself is actually Austrian. He grew up in the Austrian Empire, this multi-ethnic empire where there very much was a sense of the German nation, the German ethnic group being overwhelmed by foreigners, including Jews, especially Jews from Galicia, Eastern European Jews. That whole sort of view of the government, the view of what threatens Germany, really stems, I think, overwhelmingly from Hitler as an Austrian. It's less so of a sense for Germans. And so when they hear anti-Semitic rhetoric, they look around and say, well, the Jews are so few here, they're not really they're not that kind of problem for us. It's not something we can really worry about so much. And I think many of them turned a deaf ear to that. Because there were other things in the Nazi agenda they loved.
Before we give the audience an opportunity to ask questions, what are the biggest takeaways for you, the things that we haven't talked about that you would like to share with the audience in terms of what we've learned about it? And also, what is the Holocaust Museum doing today, you know, which is obviously something very near and dear to your heart, and why is it important that they do so?
I think the answer to both those questions for me is really the same. About 10 years ago, we were now an old institution. We were 10 years old. You know, we were founded by a unanimous act of Congress in April of 93. So after 10 years on the Mall, we had to take stock. We still today are getting about 2 million visitors a year. So it was a sense that the first 10 years, we were just trying to meet the demand of the American public for programs and for information, and that we really weren't focusing in on what the role of the Holocaust Museum could be in our democracy today. And senior staff about 10 years ago decided, well, you know, it really should be more than just a visit to the museum. We're a national institution. It should be more than an interesting program where you walk away and say, oh, that was terrible, and then you go on and you live your lives. One of the ways we're trying to make it central to the discussion about what it means to be an American, what it means to be part of our democracy, is to look at the Holocaust in a different way and to use the dilemmas that the professionals that I was talking about, what they faced in the rise of the Nazi German state and their contribution to the stabilization of the Nazi system and their role in actually committing the Holocaust. Without these non-Nazi professionals, the Holocaust would not have been possible. They made it happen. That we could use those dilemmas as a way to frame a conversation about the ethics of that profession today. So we're looking at the professions that we think safeguard democracy: military professionals, police professionals, judicial professionals, medical professionals, education professionals, government professionals, government civil servants. And we're really examining very closely what the role of non-Nazi professionals were in their contribution to the Nazi state and the Holocaust as a way to frame a conversation about the proper role of that profession in our democracy today. So the Holocaust becomes something that's alive, that professionals recognize is important to their own professional duties, that will help shape them in how they respond to whatever crisis comes up in our democracy. Because the bottom line, the thing that I really would love for you to take away from here, it's not January 30th, 1933, Hitler's chancellor, and he says, okay, today we're going to commit genocide. That's not how it happens. It's a whole series of little steps that by themselves don't look terribly dangerous. But together, they're leading in a direction and eventually lead to genocide. So it's a daily examination. Are the things that make my job easier, that make my job more fun, that make my life livable, that are changing in the profession, are they things that are strengthening our democracy, or are they things that lead somewhere else? And that's a hard question to answer, and I think the struggle to figure that out is the point.
Very good. Well, let me thank you just for a great...
So I'm wondering, when somebody visits the museum, can they leave there with some concrete examples of the types of things we need to be wary of in modern society, parallels to things that happened in past history, so we don't inevitably end up doing something similar in our society?
I think so. I think we were good at it in 1993. I think we're getting better at it every day. I think it's impossible not to see a park bench that says for Aryans only and not think of our own history and the role that we played in our own history, with especially the segregated South. I think it really is impactful when you leave the exhibit and your first view is the Washington Monument through the window of that hallway when you exit the exhibit. That you're really, Chaika Weinberg, who's the founding director of the museum, he was brilliant. He called it a bystander exhibit. So it's an exhibit really designed with Americans in mind. And it's designed to make them think about what it means to be an American, what are the values that we share, and how do we maintain that? I think we're getting better at it. Thank you for that question.
I have a question. Does the Holocaust Museum or the administration of the Holocaust Museum take a position on things that take away, it sounded like, look into those things, such as Guantanamo Bay or Auschwitz grave? How do you deal with those things?
You know, I've done a lot of programs for legal professionals, judicial professionals, prosecutors, lawyers, and those issues always come up. But I'm a historian. I'm a historian of Nazi Germany, so I really focus on the past. And it really then becomes a matter of moderating a discussion amongst them about what are their parallels, and are those legitimate parallels, and what are the problems inherent there. And I tell you, Guantanamo comes up every time. Every time.
We all have the same series of questions. And the one is, from a historical perspective, and the experience, and you're reading the history, how does it apply to what's going on in the United States today? It's the same question. And you, I'm sure you're a historian, but I know historians have opinions.
Yeah. Historians have opinions. They have personal opinions that they have to keep to themselves. I'll say it again. My job primarily is to really talk about the past in a way that I hope raises those very questions in society today, and then to moderate a discussion amongst the audience about that question. It's not really my job to tell them what to think about American society today. It's not my area of expertise, A. It's not my, I've never studied the law. I'm not a lawyer. I mean, I was interested in the history of the judicial system as a social political study. You know, these guys that were applying the law that the Kaiser wrote, and suddenly they're in Nazi Germany and they're applying the same law. Applying it in a different way, but they're still applying the law. And if that resonates with American society today about applying the law because you think you're tied to the letter of the law, even if it creates a manifest case of injustice, or applying the law according to a legal principle which you think will guarantee justice, those are two different approaches to the law that they were discussing back then, and it had implications for the fairness of the whole of the system as a whole for Nazi Germany. I think it also has implications for the fairness of our system today. But it's not for me to sort of work out exactly how that works. It's for the jurors to do. It's the work they have to do when they hear the program.
Stephanie, over here, yes.
Thank Frances Kavanagh, and I'm visiting my daughter Judy Kavanagh here. I live in San Diego. We lived in New Jersey before. I'm talking about her grandfather, her paternal grandfather. He was a Kavanagh. He was a university graduate, and he went into World War I, came out of World War I, and went to Gottingham Law School, and he was a jurist, and he served in the as a judge. Very briefly, because the economy was bad, and they started easing out the Jews. Then the only way he could survive was he was a lawyer for a Jewish investment bank. So that's how they...
In Germany?
Yeah, in Berlin.
In Berlin.
They were lucky to immigrate to New York.
Very fortunate.
Yeah. The other point, Kadad told me that they segregated in the schools. They segregated the religions. You went to public school, and after each public school, twice a week, you went to your religion. So naturally, every student in that school knew the Jewish kids.
Yes.
They really beat them up. Also, the gym, as you said, he always mentioned that they were not allowed to go to the Turnverein.
The gym club, the gymnastics club.
Yeah, gymnastics club.
So. Great point.
Thank you.
Yeah, they said that it was especially violent when they had the day that you wear your Hitler Youth uniform. That it wasn't every day you wore that to school, but there were certain days where kids were encouraged to it, and then that was the day that was really intensively beating on Jewish students.
They beat them up.
Absolutely.
Everyone who went to Hebrew instruction got beaten up. So he went to Switzerland to go to a boarding school.
Oh, I mean, it's the parents who really want to keep their kids safe and have a safe learning environment, absolutely.
Yeah, just a quick question. Based on your research, if the... based on your historical research, if the legal profession had seen its role a bit differently in that era and had attempted to apply more brakes to the Nazi agenda, would they have been successful given the dynamics at the time, or would they have simply eventually been swept aside?
Let me answer that this way. It was one thing that Hitler feared. He feared that the judicial system would put too many obstacles on his agenda. It turned out that he needn't have worried, but he feared that they would tie him to a particular interpretation of the law. So Hitler made it his role to expand as far as possible the discretion that judges had to decide cases departing from the law. Even passed the law by decree that freed courts from being tied to previous decisions. Because he felt that the judge should have the freedom to reinterpret the law in light of the Nazi rise to power. So I think that if jurors were really conscientious about applying the law as it was written, because most of the law was written before the Nazis came to power, that would have been an obstacle to Hitler, and Hitler saw that as an obstacle. Just to give you an example, this was his attitude towards lawyers and law. He said, lawyers are people either deficient by nature or made that way by usage. Right? So not known. He much preferred direct police action. But the German public, he didn't think the German public would tolerate that. German public, he was told again and again by the unofficial observers in German society that were reporting to the SD, the secret service of the SS, that the German public wanted there to be trials. They wanted the judicial system to be independent. They thought that a legitimate trial with justice had to include a lawyer for the defense, a prosecutor for the state, and a judge who was the independent expert on the law. And yet it wasn't a hindrance to it.
I wanted to thank you for coming, and I have a couple of questions. As you discussed the beginning of the rise of Nazism and the judicial system, at some point in time, maybe 41, 42, 44, it probably was evident to most of the judicial appointed people, including the High Court, that the system was crumbling. So one of the questions, what happened during that time, and if there was any kind of dissent? And the second question is, there's obviously was the decision to exterminate the Jews in a very profound fashion. And where was the, what was the judicial decisions made for that to happen?
So two very different questions. I love your first question because it really it emphasizes what happens naturally over the course of development when, you know, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. So while the judicial system was quite willing to adjust the law for the persecution of hated minorities, especially Jews, but also Jehovah's Witnesses and the Romani population and resident alien Poles, there was a whole different legal system in Germany that applied to Slavs, you know, especially forced laborers in Germany. When the war situation, where it looked like things were crumbling, then there were demands made on the judicial system by the Nazi German state that said, look, ignore what we call, what we think of as proportional justice, that the punishment has to fit the crime. Because now the political necessity means we need war discipline. And we have to maintain that there would be no breakdown of society as they saw in World War I. So they began to demand that judges, on their own authority, using an elastic clause called the Decree for the Protection, for the Combating of Public Enemies, that allowed for a really wide discretion in the radicalization of the harshening of criminal penalties. If the, in the judgment of the judge, either the crime required the war to further that crime, so that would be a death penalty case, or if the character of the defendant was such that they were a full pest, a pest on the body politic of the nation. And Hitler used the example publicly that in a time of war, purse snatching is a capital offense. And, you know, here's the logic. They need German women to work in German industry, but they've had to darken the streets in order to prevent Allied bombing of German citizens. So if a woman is then mugged and her purse is taken, she's going to be afraid to go to her job in the war industry. Well, that means those armaments won't be produced. That means Germany will be disadvantaged in fighting the war. Germany might lose the war. Therefore, purse snatching must be a capital offense. Some jurists weren't willing to go that far. Some judges weren't willing to just apply the death penalty willy-nilly. And here it's targeting racial Germans. It's not targeting a minority. Here the whole country is part of it. And it's part of the reason why I insist that the judicial system failed. Because ordinary Germans, recognizing that situation where even for minor infractions, the death penalty is the penalty, that they don't see the system as fair and just anymore. For racial Germans, they see it as merely part and parcel with a machinery of Nazi persecution. And if that happens, if an ordinary citizen thinks getting involved in a court case is a personal and professional disaster, then you have to agree that the system failed. So the reaction was that you ratchet up the pressure on the judicial system to apply death penalty in a much broader way for very, really very minor crimes. Some jurists complied, other jurists shrouded their decision with legal formalism in order to get away with not giving a death penalty. So that's your first question. So that really the result was that Germans themselves became the target of this massive system of injustice. What formerly was only targeting Jews and other nonconformists in German society, other minorities. The second part of your question, what was it again? I'm sorry.
The second part of the question is to exterminate, to have death camps and exterminate the Jews, there had to be some kind of judicial decision to permit that. And how did that come about? Yes.
You remember the decree for the protection of the people in the state that gave the police unfettered authority? But first they targeted the political opponents of the Nazis, the communists, the socialists, the trade unionists, pacifists, avant-garde artists. They were all targets of that initial. Well, that independent police authority never went away. It became a pillar of the Nazi German state. And over time, they found new targets. They targeted the homeless, vagrants, for example. They were picked up in police raids and sent to the concentration camp. And of course, eventually they're unleashed against the Jewish community. And outside of Germany, they are the perpetrators of the Holocaust on the ground in Eastern Europe. It's the police and the SS working together, committing obvious crimes. They're killing unarmed, innocent men, women, and children. They know they're doing this. But they're covered under the law by Hitler's executive authority. They're acting as the executors of Hitler's will. they're following what they thought what had the force of law, which was a Fuhrer order. It's not subject to judicial review, not subject to the normal operation of the state. They're operating as a personal, it's a personal link of loyalty between them and Adolf Hitler proper. Now, what I find very troubling by that is so many of the direct perpetrators, people like Otto Ohlendorf, they have law degrees. They have doctorates of law. And yet they don't think that's inconsistent with killing 60,000 people as part of one of these Mibble killing squads, or more than a million people in Auschwitz-Birkenau. They don't see that as inconsistent. Medical professionals, doctors are involved in the selection process at Auschwitz. They don't see that as inconsistent with medicine. They've somehow, again, perverted do no harm to do no harm to the race, so that their actions there is somehow justified as what's needed to preserve a better future for Germany. That's how they justify all of it. But it's not part of what we would call the normal operation of the state.
Yes. Go ahead.
Correct my understanding if I'm wrong, but if I remember correctly, it was Germany who actually legitimized the Jews in early 19th century and actually as a wholesale movement said you can now be a Jew and a German citizen. And so you get to 1900 and they are fully integrated. At what point were they able to be defamed and were able to be people who hold prejudices against and be able to do that? In what way was there no knee-jerk reaction to this? And then I guess the nuance of that question is, did Germany have a Bill of Rights that recognized the natural rights of its citizens? And if it's anything like America has and has had, do you think that this would not have happened if they had a Bill of Rights similar to ours?
Okay, there's a lot of questions in there. So let me start, if I can deconstruct it a little bit. The first is, you're quite right, Germany is, I wouldn't say responsible for that development of making Jews citizens of the nation, but they're part of that process. I think you could make a better argument tying that to the Napoleonic explosion in Europe, that if you treat every citizen as a citizen of the nation, then they act as citizens of the nation, so that sort of blew away all the distinctions in the law. From that development comes this idea of equality before the law. It shouldn't matter who you are or where you live or what stand in society that you reach. The law should apply to you equally the same. And another question that you had about under German law, the Bill of Rights, they were aware of the American Constitution. They were aware of the British parliamentary system. The system that they created for the Republic was a combination of the two. And in the section of the Constitution dealing with law, embodied there are constitutional protections of individual rights, but they allow the president to suspend them in a state of emergency. So when it's more essential to violate those rights in order to safeguard the nation, they permit the president to do that. That may or may not be a problem, depends on who the president is, right, and what they're doing with it. Article 109 of the Weimar Constitution safeguarded equality before the law, that every German would be treated before the law. And that's violated very early. It's a tradition that goes back to the 1700s in Germany. It's not just since the German Constitution of 1870, 1871. It goes way back into the 1700s in the original Prussian Constitution of 1850 and further back. So the first chink in the armor of equality before the law was that very first law in April 1933, where they're actually attacking the judicial system, where stormtroopers are invading courts and taking people they hold to be Jewish and publicly humiliating them. Along the motto is, we want a German justice system, not a Jewish justice system. And in order to stop the street violence, there's a whole series of correspondence between Hitler and Hindenburg about what's going on here. Hindenburg accepts that there will be a national regulation that will remove Jews from government service. He accepts that. So now suddenly you have inequality before the law. Because here you have a law that says if you're Jewish, you can't work for the government, along the lines of that there are security risks. So almost overnight, they're being redefined as not being citizens of the nation. And I think the next nail in the coffin of that is the Nuremberg Laws, where they really define them as subjects of the nation and not citizens of the country. Or where they become objects of legislation rather than part of the constituency that the government is supposed to take care of. And that's it's downhill from there. 1943, they simply say that from now on, Jews will be prosecuted by the police. They won't have anything to do with the normal judicial system.
We have time for a couple more. Here.
The Holocaust against the disabled, did Hitler just target the people that were disabled from birth, or was he targeting anybody disabled as being a drag on the state?
Great question. Well, there were two parts to it, to that policy, actually. It's in July 1933, so very soon after Hitler comes to power. In July, they make the Nazi Party the only legal party in Germany, right? At the same time, they pass a law that's called the Law for the Prevention of Hereditarily Diseased Offspring, where they then forcibly sterilize people that they think will have characteristics that are detrimental to the nation. And this is not a paltry policy. Some 400,000 Germans are forcibly sterilized because they are believed to have characteristics that harm the nation. Hitler talked about euthanasia, the so-called euthanasia killing program then, but he didn't think it would be practical or even possible in a time of peace because of the opposition of, you know, various human rights groups in Germany. There were still human rights groups in Germany, and the churches. But under cover of war, that's a whole different matter. So under cover of war in October 1939, he signs an authorization on his personal stationery, authorizing two of his personal physicians in Berlin to find like-minded doctors and cull through the patients in long-term care facilities in Germany, both for the physically and mentally disabled patients. And on the judgment of doctors. So who's making the decision here? Doctors are making the decision. And while the language couches it that they're trying to prevent unnecessary suffering by granting them a mercy death, the reality is the selection is always based on the amount of useful work they can do. Privately, amongst themselves, they talk about these patients as useless eaters, as draining the resources of Germany. Right? So one of the organizers of the program, Karl Franz, talking responsible for really the murder of 70,000 patients in the first part of the program, where they're gassing them with carbon monoxide gas in euthanasia killing centers across Germany. And in the decentralized version, where another 130,000 people are killed through overdoses of medicaments, it becomes so ingrained in the medical profession that you protect the nation, you protect the race by killing the unfit. It becomes a bizarre kind of vision of creating a healthier, more productive society by killing those they regard as unfit and unproductive. And, you know, Brandt, who's one of the organizers of this whole program, on the scaffold, he's condemned to death by an American tribunal in the so-called doctor's trial. He says, I did everything for Germany. He thinks he's done nothing wrong. A very famous pediatrician in Berlin named Wenzler, who's heralded as creating this device to help premature babies survive called the Wenzlerwanne. He was on the committee to review the patient list of babies who were malformed, and he signed authorizing their killing in this program. And he thought he was helping the nation. He saw himself as doing something good for society. You know, that's what we mean when we talk about how the Holocaust turns the values of society on its head, and doing wrong somehow becomes the right thing to do. And it really takes a very strong, I think, person with moral character, with real strong values, to remember the real values of society and say, well, this is wrong, we shouldn't be doing this.
Both of you have been patient, so I'm going to let you. Yes.
I would appeal to your capacity as a historian. I have a very profound question about the genocide against the Jewish people, which started something like 80, 90 years ago. The perpetrators of that are all dead by now. More or less.
Yeah.
There are not many left.
Very old men.
Today, we have a genocide going on in Africa. It started in Rwanda. It spread into the Congo. I used to live and work there. And we do not see it. It's on the same magnitude as what happened to the Jewish people in Europe. Does this attitude we have today have anything to do that the Jewish state, the community, wants to get $20 billion of our tax money into Israel?
I don't know if I could necessarily connect that. I think it just shows how much we have to learn. I mean, we have to look at the past and learn from the past, and we're having trouble learning that part of it, the genocides that are ongoing, that there are still so many genocides that happened after the Holocaust. And after all, the word genocide comes from the experience of the Holocaust very directly through the Jewish refugee lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, who created that word, geno, from the Greek root, and side from the Latin root, to say the murder of the people. I can tell you what the museum is very much concerned by that, and you know, we're divided into functional groups. We have a research arm called the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies. We have an education arm, which is where I am, and the National Institute for Holocaust Education. But you should know that we also have a Committee on Conscience, which is really trying to appeal to the conscience of the American nation, saying, look, here are a situation that's going on in the Congo, or in Chechnya, or in the Sudan, or in Darfur, where there is a potential for a genocide occurring here, and really trying to encourage Americans to take some kind of action to prevent it. We don't tell Americans what to do, but we try to make sure they have the information so they can make a proper decision.
John, did you have a question?
Let me join in thanking you for making us think about things that we don't think about every day, although you're still leaving us with the frustration because you're not answering our questions about the application of this history to contemporary history.
That's my job. My job is to make you frustrated about it. Make you think about it.
The particular point or question was, and I may have misheard you, but you talked about Hitler's economic policy and then you touched on it. You said he raised the salaries of various people.
Yes.
It sounds like Hitler's economic policy was very successful. Was he worrying about his national debt or inflation?
No, but
he
got
things going again. Huh?
The economists were very worried about it, absolutely. Because historians today, looking at it in the past, we see fissures that they didn't see at the time. But economists saw it, and economists worried about it because it was self-cannibalizing. It's not really sure how the Nazis could have survived without a war. That their whole economic success was based on massive deficit spending. And that's unsustainable. So they needed to conquer country after country, both without war and with war, in order then to expand into that country and take their gold reserves, their economic resources, to prop up that deficit spending. So without the war, it's hard to see how Germany could have continued to be economically successful without rearmament. I mean, literally, resources were being devoted to rearming to an extent that really pleased the army, but really gave economists headaches. People like Schacht, I mean, they're horribly worried about it.
Well, Doctor, thanks so much for...
Thank you very much, and on behalf of the World Affairs Council, we'd like to thank you for speaking to the students and for flying all the way to Juneau to speak for the Juneau World Affairs Council, coming to Anchorage, and we have a book of Alaska to entice you to come back and see your wonders.
Oh, just looking at the windows. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I guess we're done.
A big thanks to David Gostin for helping make this. Will be next Friday, and we will be featuring Stephen Cohen, the senior policy expert at the Brookings Institute, who will be speaking to us on will Pakistan become the most dangerous country in the world. We'll be speaking about the current developments in the Middle East. So, John, you will see how that relates to today and what that means for Pakistan. We'll be here in the Hilton Hotel, and we'll be starting at noon. Please RSVP.
Have a look.